Well, welcome back to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, joined again by Bill Kristol. We're not actually officially launching this until next week, but we couldn't resist it, could we, Bill?
We couldn't. It's a new year, new podcast, new news, new op-eds, new presidential instances of presidential insanity. It's great to be back.
Well, it does seem like a particularly newsy day. It is January 3rd, 2019. The House of Representatives is flipping over, and people are still talking about the president's performance at the cabinet meeting. But I want to start off by talking about what Mitt Romney did, not just the op-ed piece, but also the reaction to it. Let's start with Mitt Romney's decision, even before he takes his seat in the Senate, to write an op-ed piece that doesn't attack Donald Trump's policies, but raises questions about his character. And of course, that's generating the predictable blowback. So your thoughts on why do you think Mitt Romney chose to do that?
You know, that cabinet meeting you mentioned yesterday really, I think, makes clear what sort of is a vivid illustration of what Mitt Romney is talking about. I mean, you have Mitt Romney was a governor. He ran cabinet meetings. I assume he ran them the way previous presidents ran cabinet meetings. Maybe the press comes in for the first 30 seconds to get a photo and maybe shout one or two questions. And then you actually have a cabinet meeting where people talk about what they're doing in their agencies. And there's some exchange on issues which cut across agencies. And the president says, why don't you do more on this issue? Or, you know, maybe we need to study this. Of course, with Trump, we don't have any real governance of that kind. We have the president talks for 90 minutes to the press randomly about a million different topics with God saying all kinds of kind of amazing things. And then these cabinet secretaries praise the president. I mean, it is a little North Korea-like there.
We've seen that before. Look, I know that I use this analogy too much, but I keep coming back to the crazy uncle at Thanksgiving moment or the loudmouth at the end of the bar, and you realize, oh my God, he's running the country. Okay, very specifically.
But I mean, that just on that. Yeah, yeah. So that's what's so striking to me was that Romney's op-ed comes out late the night before, or New Year's night, I guess you call it, and then early, you know, it's in the paper the Tuesday, Wednesday morning, and then Trump has a cabinet meeting sort of proving what Romney is saying, which I think the key point is less this particular decision is bad or that particular appointment is questionable, but does this man have the basic character, the basic competence to be president of the United States? And what Romney's implying, though he doesn't explicitly raise, I don't think the question of 2020 is, fine, he's president for now, presumably he's president for the next 2 years, absent impeachment and conviction. But do we want to renominate him as Republicans? Do we want to reelect him as Americans? I think that's really what's underlying Romney's op-ed, is he's raising a huge question mark about the renomination of President Trump, as well as the question of what Republican senators should do over the next 2 years in terms of supporting or criticizing President Trump. That's what caused the blowback. Romney is really raising a pretty fundamental question about the future of the Republican Party.
And he's planting a flag about the role that he intends to play here. One of the questions, of course, was, will he become the new Jeff Flake? And for whatever reasons, you know, becoming Jeff Flake is now regarded as a pejorative. But I think it means that you will furrow your brow, you will issue statements, you might even tweet, but ultimately you will do nothing.
And in Flake's case, you will resign rather than face a tough, or retire rather than face a tough primary challenge. Romney's beginning his six-year term. He's not in any trouble politically in Utah. He's the former presidential nominee, so I don't think he'll be like Jeff Flake. Look, I think he, as he showed in his television interview yesterday on CNN, he's not going to be, he's not going to sound like me or you. Yeah. He's not going to feel compelled to.
He's not going to vote for Democrats.
He's not going to criticize everything Donald Trump says. He'll pick his spots. But I think he was putting, I mean, why did he do it before even being inaugurated? It was unusual. And I think he wanted to put down a marker that I am not going to behave the way the huge majority of Republican senators and congressmen have behaved over the last 2 years. I think he wants to encourage others to follow in his footsteps. And obviously everyone will make up their own minds about when they criticize, when they might break in terms of voting against the president. But I think he wants to reestablish a very important principle. He's elected a senator by the citizens of his state. He owes them his best judgment. He's not some, you know, ultra loyalist, tribalist team player on Team Trump.
Which, of course, is the cardinal sin. Because I love seeing Newt Gingrich come out and talk about how he was not a team player. He should be putting party loyalty over his conscience or his issues of character. I'm old enough to remember when Newt Gingrich did not play that way. I mean, before, you know, in the early 1990s, I don't think anyone would have described Newt Gingrich necessarily as a team player. But I want to read you this, the pushback from some of the Trump rationalizers, including our good friend Henry Olson from the Ethics and Public Policy Center, who wrote a piece for the Washington Post, who basically said that Mitt Romney's piece was an illustration of how wildly out of touch the senator-elect is with Republican voters. And I think this is the nut paragraph. So what are some of the others? Let's start with the article's premise, Olson writes. The president Trump's character is more important than his accomplishments or principles. Most Republicans simply don't accept this argument. Many instead see Trump's pugnacious and sometimes crude talk as an essential part of his virtue. He fights while other Republicans cower. Others would prefer that he tweet less and do more, but still prefer Trump's fallen angel to a Democratic devil.
First of all, it's not so clear from the data that Republican voters don't care about character. A lot of them have put that aside in the first 2 years. Trump was better than Hillary. Trump's judges are good appointees. Incidentally, why do Republicans like Trump's judges? Probably because they think they have good character, right? I mean, as well as good constitutional judgment. So, and why did they admire Secretary Mattis and some of the other early appointments? Because they admired their character, not just their policies. So I don't really agree with Olson that character doesn't matter for voters, for Republicans. But anyway, what kind of argument is that? If people temporarily have talked themselves into discounting character, that's no reason to go along with that. I also think Mitt Romney knows a little bit about being elected. He was elected governor of a Democratic state, Massachusetts. He's now been elected senator of a Republican state, Utah, and he was the presidential nominee in 2012. It's not like he's ever gotten any Republican votes, right?
So who actually got a higher percentage of the popular vote than
in the general election than Trump? So I mean, the notion that Romney is so out of touch, I mean, that's what a pundit who wants to rationalize Trump, honestly, and wants to rationalize Trumpism says. And instead of making a substantive argument about, well, Trump is doing a good job as president, Mitt Romney needs to just go along with Trump and not criticize him. It's all about this kind of he's out of touch and he has a like archaic belief in the importance of character.
Well, this is also a revealing moment because you are seeing the sort of the formalization of the rejection of character as a measure, and there are other pieces as well. But I do think it's also you need to go into this. Character is more than just being pugnacious and crude. I mean, we're talking about, I think it was George Will who referred to Donald Trump as a Vesuvius of mendacities. Here is a man whose corruption, whose lies, whose pettiness. And vindictiveness, his ignorance, his inability or unwillingness to rise to the office is more than a personality quirk. It is something fundamental that's here. And, Olson then goes back to this whole sort of binary choice, fallen angel versus a Democratic devil, because, we have to think of the Democrats as being, Satan incarnate. So therefore, if you're anything to the right of Satan incarnate, you must be acceptable here. But it is interesting the way in which the Republican Party has really internalized this. The ends justify the means that in fact, issues of honesty, of probity, all of those things that we just simply took for granted, that most, I think, people took for granted, are not as important as long as you get certain policy wins.
Yeah, and I think very much agree with that. And character matters for governance. Why is James Mattis no longer Secretary of Defense? It was not only particular decisions he disagreed with, though there were a couple he very much disagreed with and disagreed with the way they were made. The more he was there and looking at the next 2 years, I think he felt this was a president whose character he couldn't depend on, whose just basic stability, basic
judgment,
willingness to hear different arguments. Why is Trump, it couldn't be counted on, why is Trump increasingly surrounding himself with second and third and fourth raters and people whose main qualification is a kind of obsequious loyalty to Trump, as we saw at that cabinet meeting yesterday? Because character matters, and serious people don't want to go in there. And so that character matters for governing, and, if voters, some number of voters might want to hope that it doesn't, or hope that Trump's character is better than we think, or hope we can get through one term of it. I come back to what I said earlier, though. I think the one-term, two-term question is very interesting. You can sort of persuade yourself, he's already president after all, you don't like the Democrats, you can sort of persuade yourself we can make this work for one term. Mm-hmm. And that's what Jim Mattis tried to do, actually. And voters have tried to do that, and senators and congressmen. But the threat, and the Trump White House sees this, which is why they've reacted so strongly to Romney and talked about changing the nominating rules and so forth to try to put a thumb on the scale on the primaries. The reason the Trump White House is in a mini panic about this is when you make the question about 2020, it suddenly becomes not, you know, how critical should we be of Trump given that he's already president, but do we want another 4 years of this?
Especially when you have no illusions about what it means to put him back in the Oval Office.
Yeah, I think of the decline from the first 2 years to the second, to the likely next 2 years in terms of the quality, and then think what the quality of a second-term Trump presidency would be like. Think also about the electoral implications of renominating Trump given what happened in 2018. So I think that, that Romney's op-ed hit a nerve. And that nerve was, you can see that resonating throughout the White House and throughout the circles of Trump loyalists.
Does it change anything? Does it make it easier for other Trump skeptical office holders to speak out and to raise questions? Or will he really be shoved into the corner like Bob Corker and Jeff Flake?
I mean, a lot depends.
Does it change anything?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does. I think the reaction to it proves that, the hostile reaction by the Trump loyalists proves that. If they just thought this was meaningless, he's a senator from Utah, he's former presidential nominee, he's kind of in his own world out there, they wouldn't react that way.
Well, speaking of reaction, I want to talk about your piece. It is up, your first piece for The Bulwark, talking about the almost the immediate reaction was, let's, from some folks, Trump allies, let's actually rig the renomination process.
Yeah, a letter from email from the national committee man from the Virgin Islands. But clearly, I think, pushed by the White, I don't know if the White House was in, you know, helped him write it or encouraged him to write it. Clearly, Trump allies in Washington have been promoting it. This story came out in Washington, I think originally in the Washington Examiner, a place that's been very friendly to Trump, that also published Trump's 205 achievements just the other day, you know, and why he deserves re-election. So clearly being pushed by Trump allies in Washington, maybe by the Trump White House, they're nervous. I mean, think of it. In the last 3-4 weeks, we've had a story about how the New Hampshire people, mm-hmm. Trump allies in New Hampshire, talking about changing the traditional neutrality of the party in the first in the nation primary. South Carolina, there was some really crazy talk about even canceling that primary. There was an article about how the Trump team is trying to sort of merge with the Republican National Committee so they don't have their traditional
independence. This does not exude confidence.
No.
It doesn't suggest that they are, hey, bring it on. We're comfortable with the democratic process here.
No. I mean, what's funny is that Trump, much to our dismay, but I suppose you'd have to say to his credit, won a pretty fair and open process in 2015-16. To his credit, he ran everywhere. He didn't get deterred by the fact that most establishment Republicans didn't care for him much. But he's certainly unwilling to let that to have a fair, and he seems to be unwilling to have a fair and open process in 2020. He talks a lot about rigging the system. He's trying to rig the system of the Republican nomination. I don't think he'll succeed, but I do think it shows fear and weakness.
Well, and also, as you point out, this does reflect the degree of panic already setting in among Trumpists and evidence that beneath the superficially strong approval numbers, there's bubbling up discontent, even dread at the prospect of renominating Trump in 2020, which, of course, is what you were just talking about, the significance of the Romney comments. Speaking of the Romney, speaking of what happened yesterday, post-Romney, that where do you even start with that remarkable stream of consciousness of the president at the cabinet meeting? But one thing I think jumped out at me, and I don't think it's received really enough attention, where the president is talking about Russia and Afghanistan, justifying leaving Afghanistan, and at one point says this.
The reason Russia was in Afghanistan was because terrorists were going into Russia. They were right to be there. The problem is it was a tough fight. And literally, they went bankrupt. They went into being called Russia again as opposed to the Soviet Union.
Okay, Bill Kristol, the president of the United States endorsing the Russian invasion of Afghanistan because there are terrorists there. Those terrorists were people that we were backing, right? I mean, these were our allies at that time.
It's so wacky, you almost wonder where he got this from. And I really do wonder whether Putin or someone just told him this a few months ago in Helsinki, because it's not the actual, it wasn't the rationale in 1979. The Russians had, the Soviet Union had various, you know, phony rationales for why it was okay for them to invade a country. But there was no terrorism coming from Afghanistan into the Soviet Union. They wanted to prop up a communist government there that was in danger of falling. It was a kind of Brezhnev doctrine thing. You don't let pro-Soviet governments fall in countries that are nearby or that you care about. But so the fact that he made such a nutty justification, maybe he's just confused and we went into Afghanistan to fight terrorism, so he thinks the Soviets did. But I wonder whether this was some bizarre sort of conversation he had with Putin or someone else had with someone else who then reported it to
Trump.
Well,
you know that everything he says, he's recycling things that he heard, perhaps, you know, misunderstanding them. But that's a really interesting point. Where did he get the idea that that was the basis of it? Did he get it from Putin or from whatever conspiracy theory pro-Russian swamp that he swims in on a regular basis?
Some buddy of his telling him something totally uninformed. I can only imagine what his actual Secretary of State and National Security Advisor thought as he said this. But also, as you said, even more revealing perhaps is the fact that he expressed sympathy for the Soviets. They did the right thing. It just didn't work for them, or however he put it. I mean, this is not new. Remember, Trump was quoted years and years ago, way before he became president or even ran or even was that prominent in national politics, I think expressing sympathy for or expressing disappointment that Gorbachev hadn't cracked down in the closing days of the Soviet Union, that he let the democratic reform get out of hand. He had sympathy for the Chinese in Tiananmen Square. He basically sympathizes with dictators, unfortunately, and authoritarians, and seems to have no notion that there are, you know, we should be generally, as much as we can, on the side of people resisting dictators and authoritarians.
You know, a year ago, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, I think it would have been fair to say that that his strongest supporter, his closest ally in the Senate, would be somebody like Tom Cotton. Today, it's Rand Paul.
Yeah.
And maybe having listened to what Trump said during the campaign, this is not that surprising. But it really is striking. I think, what did you tweet out yesterday, that the Republican Party has now become the party of Brezhnev?
Yeah, just because, like, he's now accepting the Brezhnev doctrine, apparently, that they were entitled to go wherever they wished to prop up pro-Soviet governments. It's such a combination of sort of morally bankrupt and historically illiterate that you do. This is why Mitt Romney is worried. This is why a lot of people are worried. And this is why when you talk privately, of course, to Republican senators and congressmen, they're all worried. They're not foolish. But they've all felt intimidated, or they can do more good by keeping quiet. Yeah. And that's what I really wonder. I mean, that's where the Romney op-ed makes a difference. Does that begin to change?
He is saying in public what people are saying in private. But, you know, once again, you're seeing the voices attacking him, but not a lot of people willing to stand up. And I don't know, you and I are both old enough to remember when it was not complete heresy to criticize a sitting Republican president. I mean, there were, you know, going back to William F. Buckley criticizing Richard Nixon, people criticized the Bushes all the time. Yeah. It was not considered a cardinal sin. And the way that we've got to this point is someone as respected as Mitt Romney makes these comments, and it's like, how dare you criticize the president, when in fact he's really expressing what a lot of people, and I don't think we can emphasize this strongly enough, that what people say in private is very different from what they're willing to say in public.
No, I totally agree. The one thing I would say is that what also the real Trump loyalists leapt to the defense, you know, Newt Gingrich and others. Actual senators, I didn't see a lot of Republican senators rushing to get onto MSNBC or CNN or Fox to say, gee, that's terrible what our new colleague has just said. I want to say right here that I'm with Trump. Mitch McConnell and everyone just decided to take the day off. It'll be interesting when they get sworn in today and they're around war and, you know, the new Congress convenes, whether there's a big rallying to Trump. But I don't see that either. So I think that's the movement that's happened in the last 3 months. The degree to which the senators and congressmen, I think, are now, they've always thought this privately. Now they're not quite willing to say it publicly, so they're not quite willing to go where Romney has gone. But they're not really leaping to Trump's defense either. And I do think it makes the next several months much more interesting in Washington. And again, I've always also thought that the Congress would be a lagging indicator, that things in the country would change first. Because if you're a senator or a congressman, you have so much business to do with the Trump administration. I don't even mean that in a negative way. I just mean your constituents care about something and you need to get your phone call returned from the head of the EPA so you can tell them there's an oppressive regulation here that's hurting my business, you know, this business in Iowa or something. You just have a lot of actual incentives not to pick a fight with the president of your own party. If you're a governor, if you're out in the country, if you're just an activist or a business leader or something, it can look pretty different. So I think we'll see the erosion out in the country before we see it in Washington.
Well, the next 3 months is going to be crucial. There's going to be so many things going on. The headwinds this administration is facing, you know, put them in any order you like, the Democratic Congress and their investigations, the economy, which may be taking some blows, as you and I are talking right now. The stock market is down again, and the president has had low approval ratings with a high stock market, if that falls. And then, of course, there is the Mueller investigation, which is the big wild card, and we have no idea how that is all going to play out. And then if I'm a Republican and I'm watching the president's performance yesterday, I don't know how you don't have some really profound doubts about joining yourself at the hip with this.
I agree, and I think there'll be a heck of a lot to cover on the bulwark under your leadership, Charlie. So I look forward to seeing it every day, beginning Monday. Is that right?
Yeah, we're going to be doing this all on Monday. We figured we would do a special pre-bulwark podcast today because everything that was going on, and Bill has the lead story up at the bulwark right now, the reaction to Mitt Romney from the supporters of Donald Trump, whose knee-jerk reaction apparently is to, hey, can we rig the system by declaring him the presumptive nominee in 2020. You can find it at thebulwark.com. Thanks for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Charlie.
I'm Charlie Sykes, and we'll be back on Monday.